Could you handle some serious Bible study this morning on a Saturday morning? If you will, open to Mark chapter 2. That's where we'll begin. I once attended the largest Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in the city of Chicago. It takes place twice a week in the basement of what's called Holy Name Cathedral, the largest Roman Catholic cathedral, the headquarters of the Chicago parish. And also one of the smokiest gatherings I've ever been to. If you know much about Alcoholics Anonymous, or if you are a recovering alcoholic, or are close to someone who is, you know that sometimes, as people are trying to overcome one vice, they find consolation in another. Well, that was outside. Inside, I found the atmosphere to be very accepting, very open, transparent, anything but pretentious, very much like church at its best, except without the smoke. And at one point when it was time for testimonials or whatever they're called in AA meetings, this girl stood up and she said, "For the last 3 months I've been sober." And she said, "I've also been looking for my higher power. Have decided that the Christian God cannot be my higher power because it doesn't motivate me to think of this Christian God who stands over me with a scorecard in one hand and a whip in the other." I was sitting there with my son, who was 12 at the time. I thought it would be a good idea to expose him to what one of our members who led us there was experiencing week to week. And together we just winced that this would be this girl's impression of the God that we serve, that he stands over us with a scorecard in one hand and a whip in the other. I thought to myself, who is going to get close enough to that girl to flesh out faith to the extent that she will have a better understanding of this God that we serve as we see him in the face of Jesus of Nazareth? I don't think that girl's alone. I think you would have to agree with me that there are a lot of people outside our walls who have some very negative impressions of not only the God we serve, but of those of us who serve him. There's a writer by the name of George Hunter III. His book is kind of old by now. It's called How to Reach Secular People. I normally don't trust books that begin with how to. They tend to be too mechanical, treat people like they're machines. If you push the right buttons, you'll get the right response. But this is a book that I actually liked, How to Reach Secular People by George Hunter III. And in that book, taking something he said and taking it a little bit of a different direction, imagine that there are these four huge brick walls in succession. On the other side of that, you can just barely see the tip of a cross. There we are this morning, huddled beneath the cross of Jesus. But here on the outside of those four walls are all kinds of unchurched people, unevangelized people, who have some very negative impressions of those of us who gather at the foot of the cross. Written on wall number one, the first thing that shuts people out, he said, is the word image. I don't know if you know this, but we have a serious image problem. Would you agree with that? Christian people have a very negative image out there in the world. There are three parts to this image problem. First of all, people beyond our walls perceive that the Christian message is untrue. And when we talk about Christ as the key to all knowledge, when we talk about truth as if it's an absolute, a lot of people out there are turned off by such talk. Nothing can be absolutely true. You can only talk about truth if you mean a pragmatic kind of truth. This is true for me, it's helpful for me. Don't tell me that it's true for everyone because it's absolutely true. It's not only that. When I say people think the Christian message is untrue, it's not just the content of that message that they believe to be untrue. It's also the messengers themselves that strike way too many people as untrue, inauthentic. And of course, if you got your information where many of them get theirs, from TBN, with its fake hair, and its staged miracles, its faked tears, even its artificial enunciation. I mean, nobody talks like that except televangelists and nightclub singers. Then maybe you too would come to the conclusion that those people are just a bunch of fakes. First part of the image barrier is that the Christian message is untrue and that its messengers are untrue. Secondly, that it's boring. This is not wall number two. This is still wall number one that gives this negative impression of the Christian message. Secondly, that it's boring. Now, I know your youth minister's theme this year is the great adventure. But a lot of people out there think this has got to be the most boring thing in the world to do with your Saturday morning. It's boring. And third, the third part of the image barrier, is that the Christian message is just irrelevant. Because after all, religion is really all about being a good person. And hey, I'm a good person, even though I'm not a churchgoer. You may be a good person and you are a churchgoer, but really whether or not you're a churchgoer has nothing to do with whether or not you're a good person. Therefore, the Christian message is largely irrelevant. Now, the only way the average person is going to overcome the first barrier, the image barrier, is by getting close enough to somebody like you that they have a positive impression of the Christian message. Even then, when they overcome that first wall, the image barrier, then they come face to face with barrier number two, the culture barrier. Call it the stained glass curtain. You know, there was the iron curtain, now there's the stained glass curtain. And if they're brave enough to come to your church, hear you sing things like, "Here I raise my Ebenezer, hither by thy help I've come," they just think, that does not translate. Don't know what you're doing when you raise your Ebenezer, but it sounds dangerous. I don't want to raise one. Now let me quickly add, I'd be surprised if there weren't some things going on in our circles when we gather as Christian people that they didn't understand. I don't think we ought to apologize for that. We just have to be more careful about translating. When they don't understand the jargon, they don't understand why we do what we do, we have to be sensitive to those folks who are there and explain why we do what we do. And then perhaps they get past the culture barrier until they come to barrier number three. Written on it is the word gospel. You think, how could the gospel be a barrier? The problem is there are too many messages out there with the name gospel attached to them. Which gospel are you preaching? Is it the health and wealth sort of gospel? Is it the name it claim it kind of gospel? What kind of gospel do you proclaim? One more reason for me to say once again, as I said yesterday, we have to be absolutely clear about what the heart of the gospel is. And it is, as Mark concluded in Mark 1 verse 1, Jesus, the Son of God. Well, if they understand that and then understand the implications of that conviction, they come headlong, face to face, with barrier number four, which would be the commitment barrier, where they come to understand that Christ is Lord, or at least these people believe that He is, which means He lays claim to every part of my life, not just my Sunday morning life, not just my moral life. If He is Lord, He is Lord of all. He wants it all. And frankly, that's not why some people come to church. Some people came there because they were in the throes of some addiction or because their marriage was falling apart. And really, all they wanted was a Savior, somebody who could rescue them from themselves. When you talk about Jesus not only as Savior but as Lord, some people like that rich young man we'll come across later this afternoon will turn and walk the other way. And I'm sorry, there's not much I can do about that one. I'm not authorized to lower the bar, to water down the claims Jesus makes on my life or on yours. But if, because of the quality of my commitment to the Lord, that girl or anybody else out there could overcome those barriers and come face to face with Christ, it will only be because they have managed to cut through all the layers of religiosity that have been laid over the gospel in a way that obscures it. You know, if she could come to that point where she could see God as He's revealed in Christ, don't you think she'd be surprised? I know the people who saw Him first were awfully surprised. He was not the Messiah they were expecting. One, because He was not a freedom fighter. Well, at least He wasn't fighting for that sort of freedom, not political independence. Two, because if they were expecting a rabbi reformer, He didn't fit that profile either. You know, one of the things that rabbis do is they quote other rabbis. In fact, that's mostly what they do. If you know anything about how rabbis are trained, if you know what the Talmud is, the Talmud that has the Old Testament text in the center, surrounded by ancient rabbinical comments called the Mishnah, then around them are the Gemara, other ancient, just more recent rabbinical comments, up recent as in up to 900 or so A.D. I mean, that's what you study all day long, the comments of the rabbis about the Old Testament, realizing that the Old Testament doesn't spell everything out in great detail. We're not supposed to travel on the Sabbath, for example. Leviticus makes that clear. But exactly what are the limits of travel on the Sabbath, rabbis would ask one another. I mean, can we walk outside the tent at all? I'm not trying to be crude, but one ancient rabbinical question was, can we go to the bathroom on the Sabbath? And there are pages and pages in the Talmud addressing that issue. Some say yes, some say no. Mostly say yes, for practical reasons. But page after page of that discussion, can we go to the bathroom by leaving the tent, or is that a violation of the prohibition against traveling on the Sabbath? Now, if you're in those circles, then what you do is not talk so much about what Leviticus says or doesn't say, as much as you talk about what Rabbi Hillel said or what Rabbi Shammai said. And yet here comes Jesus of Nazareth, who teaches as one who had authority. The passage we read yesterday, Mark 1:27, where that said, I think it has more to do with the fact that he's casting out a demon at the moment. He's teaching with authority, as in he backs up everything he says with some act that only God in the flesh could do. But it also suggests, I think, that here's a man who says this is what God has in mind, and he doesn't quote anybody, except maybe an Old Testament prophet here and there. But he certainly doesn't quote human beings. He teaches as one with authority. By the way, next time your child complains about writing a term paper and all these sources they have to cite, you tell them that they can blame that custom on the Jews. The reason we reference others when we write a term paper is because of that Jewish part of our own heritage. Jesus doesn't footnote with any reference to any other human being. He teaches as one who had authority, which is one more reason why he was not what they expected. And then, he just didn't fit with the religious establishment of his time, which is what brings me to chapter 2 this morning. I want us to fast forward through four different scenes, beginning in Mark chapter 2, verse 13, which tell us why Jesus is out of sync with the religious establishment of his time, show us reasons why he doesn't fit with those folks. Four scenes that I think would come as a great surprise to that girl at that AA meeting in Chicago. They might even surprise you when you hear them again for the first time. By the way, if you don't know what we're doing, you weren't here yesterday, I am selling the idea that we ought to present the gospel according to a gospel, rather than relying on those old, quick proof texts where basically you get somebody in the water in 30 minutes. We got to introduce people to Christ, and then we tell them how to respond to the gospel. I actually use a little outline when I study the Bible with people, and it's taped into the back of my Bible. I just thought some of you might want to see that. It's not rocket science, but I do have copies of it here down front. If you'd like to get one and follow along, just feel free to come down to the front and pick one up. Scene 1, Mark 2:13. Once again, Jesus went outside beside the lake. Somebody quick, sing an invitation song. Make me look good. Once again, Jesus went outside beside the lake. A large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. As he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, Jesus told him, and Levi got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners, the NIV puts that in quotation marks, I think appropriately so, were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" On hearing this, Jesus said to them, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Ever felt that way before? I mean, as I'm scrambling to go from one committee meeting to the next committee meeting, And then I'm responding to all these students who make appointments and want to come and tell me about their latest problem or their boyfriend or girlfriend issue or something like that. And I think we've just run out. I knew that I was up against Walling yesterday, and I figured that we would only have a handful of people requesting these things. If you would like one, if you'll send me an email to mcox@harding.edu, I'll send it to you. Send me an email, ask for the mark outline, and I'll send you one. Let's see, what was I just saying? Oh, yeah. Committee meetings, things like that. And I think to myself sometimes, you know, I would be such a better teacher if it weren't for all these students. I think I've talked to doctors who feel that way. You know, so much of their time spent in doing all these auxiliary things. Man, I'd be a better doctor if I didn't have all these sick people around all the time. Why can't I treat some healthy people? Well, sorry, bud, that comes with the territory. And here we are in church, minding our own business, and in walks some sinner. It's not dressed right. They don't act right. They talk too loud. They pass notes. They don't really understand what communion is about. So annoying. Yeah, I think that's kind of the Pharisees' reaction to Jesus. You know, that word Pharisee comes from a word, we think, that means parash, means to separate. It says something about their agenda, which was to keep themselves so separate from everybody else, even from their fellow Jews who were not as conservative, that means not as scrupulous about law-keeping as they were, that it would be obvious that they, the Pharisees, the separate ones, are the true followers of God, the true chosen people. Therefore, when they get around Jesus, who doesn't seem to be nearly as careful about maintaining such separation with sinful people, they think, well, this can't be the Messiah. Remember that scene from Luke 7 where there's a banquet? And that woman, that sinful woman, I think the same woman in the same incident we read about yesterday in John 12. When this woman who has a sinful reputation in the town comes and anoints his feet and wipes his feet with her hair, when the host at the end of the table sees this happening, he says to himself, well, if that man were really a prophet, he would know what sort of woman this is, that she is a sinner. You know that's not the problem. The problem is not that Jesus doesn't know what kind of woman that is. The problem is that man, that Pharisee, doesn't know what sort of Messiah he is, that he would keep company with such people. I'm a professor of other religions of the world, and I don't mean Baptist and Methodist. I mean Muslim and Hinduism, things like that. And it strikes me there's a pattern through them all that really holy people withdraw from the world. You want to find a holy Hindu? You won't find him mixing it up with a crowd like this. You'll find them withdrawn, sitting in some Hindu ashram somewhere, meditating, perhaps even speaking only one day a year. That is the height of holiness for most religious people. And so it's quite surprising, it breaks the religious mold to find Jesus mixing it up with people, sinful people, and somehow not being tainted by that. In his own day, perhaps the holiest of the holy were the Essenes. Essenes, even more strict than Pharisees, because they'd already decided that they could not maintain perfect holiness and live next door to other people who were not Essenes. So they withdrew to the desert. They're out there living by the Dead Sea, wearing white clothes, a symbol of their purity, practicing celibacy, another symbol of their purity, although not a very good church growth strategy. Don't know any Essenes today, do you? Assuming that when Messiah comes, he will look for the holiest people. The holiest people will be the ones most set apart from the rest of the world. And Messiah did come, but surprise, he didn't come there. Who would have known? He came smack dab right in the middle of the world. I was on a lectureship program a few years back, the theme of which was Bridge Over Troubled Waters, from the old Simon and Garfunkel song, an appropriate theme for what we're about in Christ. I was the first speaker, so I took the liberty to raise some questions about this bridge we're trying to build across these troubled waters. What kind of a bridge is it exactly? I ask. Maybe a suspension bridge high above the troubled waters below, so that no matter what's going on down there, even if people are drowning, you probably won't even hear their screams. Or maybe it's more like a drawbridge, where we race across the drawbridge into Christian Fort and pull the cables, draw the bridge up behind us and shut the world out, which is not a terrible agenda, I know, sometimes. Perhaps that's what we're doing here this weekend. Maybe for some it's more like a covered bridge. We put on our blinders and race across. I think it's supposed to be more like a pontoon bridge. You reckon? Which isn't nearly as pretty as any of those others, but who has time for pretty? This is war. So we lay a pontoon bridge across those troubled waters, which means it gets kind of wobbly, because we do mix it up with what's troubling the waters. And sometimes we get splashed by what troubles those waters. But it's a pontoon bridge, this bridge we lay across the troubled waters. I'm troubled sometimes when I get around some of our Christian people who act as if the height of Christian devotion for them is when they're at work and people are cussing and they say, "Please don't cuss around me." Now, that doesn't mean that we go to the opposite extreme and say, "Please cuss around me. Hey, you want to cuss? Hey, I'll cuss with you, make you feel better. Let's tell some dirty jokes while we're at it." That's the other extreme. But sometimes it's as if we fight to keep those folks out, rather than fight to win them to Christ, who mixed it up with them and consequently fell out of favor with the holiest of the holy in his day. Surprise. Scene 2, chapter 2, verse 18. Now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. Some people came and asked Jesus, "How is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours are not?" Jesus answered, "How can the guests of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? They cannot, so long as they have him with them. But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, and on that day they'll fast." A little bit complicated. How often were the Jews required to fast? Do you know? I mean, required to fast. Anybody know? Is this a class or a sermon? This is a class, right? Okay, good. How many know? Ron, how often were they required to fast? One day. Which day? Day of Atonement. One day a year. Pharisees, always interested in being more strict than God, they upped it to twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, we think. They fasted. You know something about how they fasted too, don't you? If you've read Matthew 6 and the Sermon on the Mount before, they don't wash their face, they don't comb their hair, they mope around just begging for somebody to ask them, "What's wrong with you?" It's like they're wearing a sign, "Ask me why I look this way." A t-shirt that says "Fast Fest 2005. I get the impression from the first part of Jesus' answer here that, hey, this is a party. I mean, the bridegroom has finally come. This is not a time for fasting. This is a time for feasting. Now the time will come when the bridegroom is taken away, and then they'll fast, although I think I hear between the lines there that it won't be like that kind of fasting. And I hear it not just between the lines, I hear it in the lines in Matthew 6, that it certainly won't be like that, fasting like the Pharisees fast. But then he adds this unusual statement, verse 21. "No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the new piece will pull away from the old, making the tear worse. And no one pours new wine into old wine skins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and both the wine and the wine skins will be ruined. No one pours new wine into new wine skins." Now, what does that have to do with the question about fasting? It's interesting. Some scholars believe that it has nothing to do with the question about fasting. This is one more quote that Mark had, and he didn't know where to stick it. Remember writing those papers? You had to have 10 references, and you got 9 of them in there. You got this 10th one. It doesn't really fit anything you've said in this paper so far, but you'll stick it on page 8, hoping the teacher isn't still reading the paper by page 8. And just stick it in there. Some scholars say that's exactly what Mark did when he inserted this unrelated comment about wine and wineskins. I don't think so. I think Jesus is taking a step back from the picky question about fasting, talking about a bigger picture issue. The real issue here is not fasting or not fasting. The real issue here is you guys are taking everything I say and trying to fit it into an old legal framework. And when you do that, not only do you miss the point of what that old law was about, you miss the freshness of all that's new that I come to represent. I didn't come to patch up your old law. I didn't come to do what the rabbis do, to close some loopholes, to clarify about Sabbath day journeys and such things. It's not why I'm here. I came to give you a whole new set of clothes. This isn't just a new covenant. It's a new kind of covenant. We missed that. We've missed it. We've misrepresented it to the world around us. The people like that girl at AA. When she hears us talk about the Bible, she assumes it's like other holy books. It's a collection of rules and regulations. Do this, don't do that. Do this, don't do that. That's what she thinks it is. We don't help any when we take all this new wine and we stuff it into that wineskin. I wrote a title of an article years ago. I'm good at writing titles of articles, just not very good at writing articles. It was going to be called Looking for Leviticus. I wrote it back in college, that title. Looking for Leviticus. I was just coming to faith, a faith of my own, as I was poring over the Gospel of Mark. After Mark, I went to 1 John, took my red pen, and marked in my copy of 1 John every time John said something like, "This is how you know." I grew up in a church where it was arrogant to say you knew much. You certainly couldn't say, "I know I'm saved." It was a little iffy to say, "I know that my Redeemer lives," even though that came straight out of the Bible. But you certainly couldn't say, "I know that I'm saved." You had to say, "I hope that if I've been found faithful on that last day, hopefully by the skin of my teeth somehow, I might." And John just says, "This is how we know." Then I read Galatians, and it's in Galatians. My little pen and wrote in the margin, "Looking for Leviticus." Isn't it true that trying to find a Leviticus-like text in the pages of Matthew to Revelation, that's produced a lot of the nitpicking sorts of controversies and all the division that's plagued us for so long? I'll tell you why it isn't there. It's because this is a new kind of covenant. That girl in Chicago needs to know that. Maybe you need to know that too. I was driving along the interstate somewhere, coming home from some place. Driven probably about 20 miles one stretch where I had not paid attention at all. Do you ever do that? Isn't that amazing that you survive? I mean 20 miles and I'm totally oblivious to what was going on around me. I mean, I guess if someone had flipped a vehicle in front of me, I might have noticed that, but 20 miles. Now, I had noticed that there were people passing me, and I was in the right-hand lane. I was driving like a church van, so that's why I was driving a little slower. Speed limit was 70, and I had the cruise control set on 72.5, because I feel holy at 72.5, you know. You got to figure that the odometer, the speedometer, is probably not calibrated exactly right, and the wheels are probably not exactly the right size. And so 72.5 is probably 70. So I feel okay doing that. And people passing me still, so they're obviously doing faster than I am. And then I kind of snapped too, because I noticed I had changed lanes and I was passing all those people who just passed me. So I kind of woke up and thought, "What's going on?" And looked ahead, and about a quarter mile up, sure enough, there's a state trooper. So I very calmly go over back into the right lane at turn off the cruise control and drop down to about 69.75, just like the state trooper's doing, and act like that's about how fast I was going all along. You could just feel the tension of our collective drivers there on the highway, thinking to ourselves, how long is the state trooper going to accompany us down this road? It's an interstate, you know. No telling how far he's going to drive. Hopefully, he's not going to be all the way to Memphis. I was coming from Nashville. The guy drives with us 20 miles, and I thought, oh, man. And then we saw him put on his turn indicator and take off the ramp, you know. And, of course, for that first mile or so, nobody speeds up. Because he may be doing that very annoying state trooper tricky thing to do, going up the off-ramp and coming down the on-ramp just to see who was faking it. Faking obedience, you know. And then very slowly, we all very calmly just ease forward a little bit, speed up some, act like there's nothing wrong. Well, right when I first pulled over into the right lane, when I saw the state trooper, I thought, aha, this is an illustration of something. I don't know what yet. But I'm always looking for illustrations, like you are too, probably. This illustrates something. What is it? And I thought about it all the way home. Went to one of my classes and said, okay, here's the scenario. What does this illustrate? If this were spiritual life and God is somewhere in this picture, where would he be? And of course, we're all thinking the same thing, but nobody wants to say that because that sounds too legalistic. We know he's not the policeman who's out to spoil my fun, to regulate my speed. We know there's more to it than that, but that's what we're all thinking. Somebody said he would be the accelerator, which is good, I think. Someone said, if God were in that picture, he would be like the highway signs guiding me along. Okay, fine. Some good old boy from Arkansas said, well, he'd be the 454 four-barrel in my engine. And I had no idea what that meant, so I said, that's great. Billy Bob, thank you very much for that comment. Now I had more time to think about it than they had. And I thought, you know, God doesn't have to be in this picture. This is a Monty Cox illustration, not a biblical one. But if he were in that picture, I would imagine him sitting in the front seat next to me, like my dad, teaching me how to drive. Still, after 30 years, he's still teaching me how to drive. But at least he lets me drive. And he'd say, now, Monty, I want you to drive very carefully, son. Now, I should tell you, back when he was first teaching me to drive, he was more like Leviticus. Turn left, turn right, slow down, that's too fast, do this, do that. Kind of like when I was teaching my kids to drive. Fortunately, they all know how to drive now. And my youngest daughter, I think, is just about to finish therapy because of the whole experience. That was the Leviticus driving school she went to, shouting instructions at her at every turn. But I picture God saying, son, I want you to drive carefully, like your older brother. And I want you to remember one thing. You're driving my car. You were bought at a price. You are not your own. Therefore, glorify God in this car. If I really understood that, I think I would drive more carefully. I think I would live more carefully than if 20 state troopers were escorting me down the highway of life. Don't you think so? I'm not trying to introduce that woman in Chicago to some book of rules and regulations. I'm trying to introduce her to the Word who was made flesh and dwelled among us and dwells among us still and longs to bring that woman into a living, loving relationship with Him. It's a totally new kind of covenant. Maybe you didn't know that. Well, surprise. Scene 3. Mark 2:23. We'll speed up. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields. And as his disciples walked along, they began to pick some heads of grain. The Pharisees said to him, look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath? He answered, have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need in the days of Abiathar the high priest? And there's a textual issue there you'll have to wrestle with as you guide an unbeliever through this. But he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful only for priests to eat. And he also gave some to his companions. Then he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Walking through the grain fields, just plucking the heads of the grain, plopping in their mouths as they walk along. And the Pharisees essentially accused them of harvesting. Imagine, you're sitting on the front lawn somewhere, And you've got those little blades of grass just plopped in your mouth, just sitting there having a conversation, and someone comes up and says, well, thank you for mowing the lawn for us. Are you mowing the lawn? They're accused of harvesting when all they're doing is plopping heads of grain in their mouths, apparently. And then Jesus points back to this old illustration where David, when he was hungry, a fugitive fleeing Saul, he ate the showbread. I mean the showbread. Those are God's 12 loaves that represent the 12 tribes. If anything is taboo, I'm thinking it's taboo to eat the showbread. But Jesus said if it was okay to eat that in this exceptional situation, then you guys, you talk about the law as if there are never any exceptions at all. You've missed the point. The Sabbath was made for you, for your benefit, not the other way around. I hear that. I always think of my friend Dr. Zaman. Dr. Zaman is a Muslim in Memphis. I teach Islam at Harding and take my students on field trips to Chicago and Memphis both. And on that Memphis field trip, we meet Dr. Zaman. Wonderful, sweet, gentle Muslim man who welcomes us there and explains. Once he was explaining the Quran to my students who had already studied the Quran. He was explaining to them that, you see, the Quran, the Book of Heaven, when Muhammad, the story allegedly goes, in 610 AD at the age of 40, he's on a mountain there near his home in Mecca. He has this vision. It's Jibreel. You and I call him Gabriel. In Arabic, he's called Jibreel. Jibreel appears, the archangel. First word out of his mouth is, recite. Recite, Muhammad. In other words, repeat after me. In Arabic, the word recite means Quran. Quran. Recite. Recitation. And so Muhammad just repeats after Jibreel, comes down the mountain, repeats it to his friends, and eventually those friends write it down. It's the Quran today. A recitation of what Muslims believe is the Book of Heaven, the dictated book that's been in heaven even before people were created. With that in mind, Dr. Zaman told one of my students in answer to one of their questions once, he said, God created people so we would have some people to obey his book. You know, I think I used to think that about the Bible. Like God created a bunch of people to have some people to obey his book. Then I read that. Sabbath was made for you. God, the designer, has designed life with himself in the middle. He knows what he's doing. So you entrust your life to the designer. You live according to his design. The Sabbath was made for you, not the other way around. I was talking about that just Wednesday night. At the end of yet another long day of work, followed by a long series of meetings. Thought about this after many long Sundays. I know people who come to Tulsa are accustomed to those very long Sundays, aren't you? Boy, when Sunday is over, I think, phew, glad that's done. I can go back and rest tomorrow at work. Just Wednesday night, I was saying to somebody, jokingly, my next revolutionary idea, you know, after I tell people about how to present the gospel according to a gospel, my next revolutionary idea is this. Why don't we agree together as a faith community, we're going to have one day of week, just one day of week, that we're going to set aside as a day of rest. Wouldn't that be a good idea? I think that'll sell. Sabbath was made for you. Don't get confused as if this is some arbitrary collection of rules and regulations. And then finally, scene 4, on into the next chapter. I'm hoping, too, that you're seeing something of a pattern in these stories. I'm not inventing the pattern. These stories are told together, I think, because they fit a similar theme. Jesus in conflict with the religious leaders of his day. But one serendipity of guiding an unbeliever or a recent believer through the Gospels is as you go and you make the connection from paragraph to paragraph, you are teaching them the most important principle of biblical interpretation, which is read paragraphs. Just a little side note. Now, scene 4, chapter 3, verse 1. Another time he went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, stand up in front of everyone. Then Jesus asked them, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? But they remained silent. And that silence makes him mad. He looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man, stretch out your hand. Poor withered hand, man. Stretches out his little withered hand. He stretched it out and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. This group of people who care more than just about anybody else about what the law says. And yet they're reading it like this. Instead of reading it like that. How sad is that? And in their devotion to the law, they missed the whole point of the law. What it means to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor, including your withered hand man neighbor. Missed the point. You ever read the Bible like that? I picture some old guy who loves maps. Doesn't have to be a guy, doesn't have to be old. But that's the way I picture it. Some old man who loves maps, lives by himself, surrounded by his maps. You go to Map Man and you say, Map Man, where's Timbuktu? And he pulls out the map. Timbuktu is an actual place. And he says, well, sonny, Timbuktu, yeah, that's in a country called Mali. You go to Africa and you kind of turn left. I guess depending on where in Africa you go, but you turn left and you go to Mali, and then you turn right and you wind up in Timbuktu. And that's how you get there. You can tell me how to get there. And I say, well, Grandpa, tell me what it's like. What's it like to be in Timbuktu, to feel the desert wind on your face? And embarrassed, Grandpa says, well, son, I've never actually been there. Does that strike you as sad? Somebody who knows the map, but has never made the trip? I don't want to be that man. I want to be a guy who is inspired by the Word who was made flesh to make the trip, to form that relationship with Him. I don't want to be like a Pharisee who is blinded by what I read here rather than guided by it, as so many have been. In such a way that that girl at that meeting in Chicago is so turned off of people like me. It is not surprising to me that Jesus reserves His harshest words for those overly scrupulous, legally minded people who were blinded by the law rather than guided by it. Well, we have a burden to bear. Our task, as you know, is to flesh it out. Flesh out this faith of ours in such a way that those in our own spheres of influence will see us and overcome, first and foremost, that image barrier. All those negative impressions they have of Christian people will be overcome because of the quality of devotion to Christ they see in your life. They see that you believe it's true, not just helpful, but true. You seem to be true and authentic. Your life doesn't seem to be boring. You seem to be on the go all the time in good, healthy, godly ways. It's obvious from listening to you, from watching your life, that your Christian faith is integrated into everything you do. It's exceedingly relevant. There we go, overcoming image barrier. They even come and assemble with you in your church or your small group, and they hear in the way you talk about it that you are willing to translate all those songs, all those rituals filled with jargon so that they can understand it. That you yourself are willing to think outside the box, think like, what would this look like to non-religious people? And explain it to people so that they can overcome the culture barrier. You're very clear about what drives you at the heart of the gospel. Jesus, the Son of God. So you overcome the gospel barrier. And then when it comes to the commitment barrier, you do not lower the bar. But instead you make it clear we are going to stand shoulder to shoulder with you as you, together with us, come to learn what it means to live under the Lordship of Christ. And then, and only then, will people like that girl come to the foot of the cross where they see the gospel, which is Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of God. We cannot be content to float about by ourselves here in Christian Ark, all safe and dry, when there are people drowning out there. God bless us to reach them. Let's close with prayer. Oh God, I do pray that You will inspire us all as we leave these gatherings this weekend to go home, to pray more fervently than we ever have for opportunities to open our mouths and speak our faith to people around us who don't share it, and to flesh it out in every way before them. Lord, I pray that You would use each one of us as representatives of this gospel that we cherish to make it clear what this gospel is, the truth of Jesus of Nazareth, and all the implications of that truth. And I pray, Father, that we would demonstrate those truths appropriately in our lives as we live out His Lordship. Please, God, give us the inspiration we sometimes lack and help us hold on to it all year long, all life long. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.